glad to have the opportunity to talk at the Tenebrionoid Symposium. As a bit of background for myself, I had actually started out in scarabs, and I conducted the thank you, the Scarabioid of Wisconsin for my master's project. I decided to kind of branch out into a different family and landed in the Tenebrionoidea with the Edemeridae, but I still kind of keep my fingers in both of those groups, but I've taken quite a shine to Edemeridae after having done this particular project. I looked at two genera occurring in Edemeridae, and I'll be talking about Sicinies. My other genus was Diplectrus. They may or may not be closely related, not quite sure yet. So just a bit of background on the Edemeridae. At least according to Croson, this appears to be a well-defined monophyletic family within the Tenebrionoidea, but it's unclear as to the relationships to other families in the Tenebrionoidea. There may be a possible relationship to Scraptiidae. There are some genitalic differences, however. Also Cephaloon of Stenotracheilidae, but again, there are some genitalic differences there as well. Okay. All right. So Edemeridae itself is a modestly sized family, only 1,500 species, in about 115 genera. The larvae are typically found in moist decaying wood. There are differences in where you find inland species versus coastline preferences. More of the inland species tend to like conifers. More of the coastline species, you'll find them in driftwood. There really aren't any economically important species in this group other than the wharf borer, and this one tends to burrow into pilings of wharves, but it may cause a bit of structural damage, but like nothing too significant. The adults are found on flowers and foliage. You can sometimes find them in moist to rotten wood, and there are many species that are attracted to blacklight, especially some of the island species. And many in this group are aposematically colored. There's a lot of very interesting and very pretty color patterns going on. And this may be due to the fact that many of the Edemerids, it's not known if all of them have cantharidin, but many do, so there is the potential to cause blistering. But it's not really worked out as to how the Edemerids are producing this cantharidin or for what purposes it is being used. But for anybody who's had experience with cantharidin, it can cause some blistering, and it can be rather painful. And as you can see in this picture, there are a couple necrotic pits there. The amount of severity kind of depends on the sensitivity of the person. You know, some people don't seem to have any reaction at all. I myself, I'm allergic to almost everything on the planet, but so far I've been okay. I haven't had any problems with the cantharidin or Edemerid, so I'm hoping that will continue. As far as the classification within the family, it's a painful mess. It isn't even certain how many subfamilies there are. There have been between 2 to 4. Generally, 3 are typically recognized. Calopodinae, Nycerdinae, and Edemerinae. Arnett, who was the kind of last New World worker on this group, had put together a manuscript, which is unpublished, but he actually had 4 subfamilies. The tribal level is even more screwed up. As far as placement of the tribes into these different subfamilies, how many tribes there are, and if you look at larvae versus adults, you get some different ideas as to tribal classifications. So when I was looking to do a project within the Edemeridae, I wanted to try to find groups that seem fairly well defined, more basal than derived, and of fairly manageable size, especially after doing my master's thesis with the Scarabioidea. That could have been a mini PhD because I was dealing with about 184 species, of which I had to write profiles and keys. but then of course I go ahead and pick two Jenner and Edamirids, and then just a glutton for punishment, I guess. But one of the groups that I looked at was the tribe Didelinae, and when I was going through some of Arnett's previous publications, I had noticed he had talked about two genera in particular, Diplectris and Sicinis. And he had mentioned that with both of these groups, they were in need of revision, and it looked like there were some species that occurred in one of the genera that probably belonged in the other, and vice versa. So I figured, you know, this would probably be a good starting point, would be to, you know, choose a genus, or in my case, two genera, and just kind of work from the ground up, do some species-level work. So I chose the group Sicinis, and to give you an overview of this genus, it was originally described by Champion, and he listed the type, well, he did not list a type. Species for this group. Arnett later went through and chose Sicinis suturalis as the type species. And Arnett did mention that he had later regretted his choice because it looks like a lot of the species that are in Sicinis don't really match with this particular type. But the characters that Champion had used to kind of define this genus were that they have long bifid exposed mandibles, a apical maxillary palpomere that is long and narrow, and usually oblique or with a truncate apex. The head is as broad or broader than the prothorax, and the pronotum usually has 1 to 2 transverse grooves or depressions on each side. And typically the elytra have a series of double lines or fine costae. Historically, there were 35 species placed into this genus Sicinis. There are no larvae known for any of the species. And the majority of Sicinis occur in Central to South America. However, there is one species, Sicinis championi, which appears to be endemic to southwest Arizona. So right here is the list of species historically placed into Sicinis. The one with an asterisk, suturalis, is again the type species. So you can see that most of these species are described by Champion, but there have been some described by Peak. So my research objectives in conducting this revision were to, first of all, examine the types of each species historically assigned to Sicinis, and to seek a monophyletic interpretation of Sicinis based upon a completion of anatomical character analysis of adults, and to conduct a cladistic analysis of Sicinis based on these anatomical and morphological characters of adults. I was unable to do a molecular analysis simply because the material is not available. And finally, but most importantly, I wanted to create keys to species in order to start to get some identifications on these Edamirids. So in the taxonomic revision of Sicinis, what I found was that there is a definite Sicinis clade that appears to be supported by 5 synapomorphies. In the one right here, the apical maxillary palpomere tends to be rather short and kind of culturform, is knife shape. And if you look at antennomeres 3 through 5 right here, they tend to be slightly thickened, more so than the rest of the segments. The elytra tend to be rather broadly rounded apically. And also, if you look at the elytral costae, they come out fairly strongly here, and the striae are very strongly impressed. So after conducting this taxonomic analysis, what I ended up with was a Sicinis clade consisting of 10 species. There was one species, Sicinis scutellaris, that was synonymized under Sicinis personatus. There are 3 species that are remaining in Sicinis. They're Incertae sedis, Enipocalus and infasciatus, I could not locate the type for either one, and there was just no reliably identified material. The third one, Sassini's Mathenae, is definitely not a Sassini's. At this point, I'm not sure where it should be placed. I'm still investigating other related genera, looking at some other neotropical groups, and I haven't quite found a decent home for it, but hopefully I will soon. There was a second clade that came out very distinctly from Sassini's, and this would be Cantherosassini's. I call it Cantherosassini's because this group, they tend to look kind of cantheridish to me, whereas the true Sassini's clade, they look more kind of like lysid mimics. So within this Cantherosassini's clade, there are 12 species. And for the remaining species, a few were transferred out of Sassini's, and there were three moved to the genus Metusinosa. And you might notice that the species Sassini's guyanensis, there are actually three synonyms that belong under guyanensis. And also there were three species that were transferred out of Sassini's and moved to Diplectris. So looking at Cantherosassini's, this new genus, I noticed there were four synapomorphies that seemed to support this group. In contrast to Sassini's, if you look at Cantherosassini's, the antennal segments 3 through 5 are not thickened slightly, they're all filiform. And the sides of the elytra tend to be subparallel, so you don't really see that apical rounding. You can see that very well right here. And there are fewer elytral costae. There tend to be 2 to 3. And the striae are not as strongly impressed. So after conducting this taxonomic analysis, I conducted a phylogenetic analysis of both of these clades. And I chose a few outgroups to use. I chose Diplectris and Metusinosa initially. I chose both of these because I had species that I moved out of Sassini's and put into both of these genera, so I thought they might be good to look at. And I also chose Europlatosassini's. This had been described as a subgenus of Sassini's, and Arnett later elevated it to its own generic status. For my cladistic methods, I used McLeod, and in the initial matrix, I looked at both Sassini's and Cantherosassini's, plus the three outgroup taxa. I had a total of 31 characters, 14 were binary, 17 were multi-state. I know that's a rather small amount of characters, but again, I was just dealing with morphological characters at this point. So under the program POP, I used a heuristic search, and I used the following settings of keeping the best trees only, using stepwise addition to get starting trees for branch swapping. I used a simple addition sequence, holding one tree at each step, and used TBR as the swapping algorithm. I told it to save multiple trees, and when saving however many best trees, to swap on those best trees only. I also used successive approximations character weighting, so after each heuristic search was conducted, each character was reweighted. And the settings used here were to reweight the characters according to the consistency index, and if there was more than one tree, to use the maximum value or best fit. And I started with a base weight of each character equaling 1, so I did not pre-weight any of the characters. So the results of my cladistic analysis for this initial group of Sassini's and Cantherosassini's, in my initial heuristic search, I came up with 304 trees, each with a length of 105 steps. But I reached stability after just one iteration and ended up with a strict consensus tree built from 9 trees, 33 steps total. So my consistency index, 0.66, it was better than 50%. Retention index, much better. And the homoplasia index, fairly low, so that was also a good thing to see. So this is the initial cladogram that I came up with. And the two big groupings here, 94% of the time, the Sassini's clade came out together, so I was glad to see that. A little less support for the Cantharosassini's clade here. There are a couple of things you may notice on this tree that I will point out. One of the issues was that my outgroup, Europlatosassini's, was pulled into the Sassini's clade, and it actually came out as a sister taxon to Sassini's championi. This was because there were several characters that were shared by both taxa in the initial matrix, and I wasn't able to get very good resolution between those two species. But if you kind of closely evaluate your Europlatosassini's, there are some very distinct characters that would support that it is a distinct genus and not simply a part of Sassini's. Another thing that was kind of interesting is that Cantharosassini suffusus actually came out as a sister taxon to Sassini's instead of coming out in the Cantharosassini's clade. And I think the big issue here has to do with the tarsi having multiple setose patches. And Europlatosassini's and Sassini's championi also have this issue of multiple setose patches, as does the genus Diplectris. But Cantharosassini's suffusus is the only Cantharosassini's that has multiple setose patches. All of the other Cantharosassini's just have maybe one patch on each of their tarsi on their prothoracic, mesothoracic, metathoracic legs. When I next conducted just a cladistic analysis of Sassini's, I used Europlatosassini's as an outgroup, and I also conducted a separate cladistic analysis of Cantharosassini's, and I chose to use Metusa nosa as the outgroup rather than Diplectris. And that was because when I was doing the taxonomic analysis, I had removed several species from Sassini's and had placed them into Metusa nosa. And there was also the issue of the multiple setose patches again. That seems to just be a very plastic kind of homoplasious character. So in my analysis of the Sassini's clade, you can see that Europlatosassini's again came out right near Sassini's championi. And 100% of the time, Sassini's championi came out basally to the rest of the Sassini's here. So just to look at some of the trends that might be going on, with Sassini's championi, this tends to be the oddball of Sassini's. Again, it is the only Sassini's that is found in North America. It appears to be endemic to southern Arizona. It has a few different features from the rest of the Sassini's, in that, again, it has multiple setose patches on its tarsi. It tends to have a longer head as well as a more elongate, more parallel pronotum. So it's possible that perhaps this species maybe does not belong in Sassini's, but for now it does fit those other synapomorphies for that genus, so it remains. The next three are very interesting examples of some lysid mimics, particularly Lysiformis. You have another grouping of Suturalis, which again is the type species, Dilaticornis and Eximius. Eximius is the only Sassini's that tends to have two color variants in it. This does not appear to be a sexually dimorphic issue, just kind of two different colors there. The last three, Adonis, Bivitatus, Fasciatus, These are all kind of distinct, particularly Sicinis adonis. It's a very pretty beetle, one of my personal favorites, with the orange and blue there. As for the Cantherocicinis, this is what the tree came out, and again, it was hard to get very good resolution in the tree at the species level, given the number of characters that I used. Particularly if you look at some of the color patterns and that going on with the beetles, some of these species are very distinct. They have some very distinct color patterns. Particularly with Parasoloides, has a bicolored elytra. Cephusus has two color forms, but again, this is the only species of Cantherocicinis that has more than just one setose tarsal patch. It has at least two setose tarsal patches. The two on the bottom, Lineatocolus and Vitatopennis, both have distinct pronotal stripes, whereas the remaining Cantherocicinis do not. All the rest of these Cantherocicinis, except for Sinanjae again has two color variants. That is not a sexually dimorphic issue again. But even the color variation on the left, you'll notice that these remaining species are all orange and black. So this is the kind of most difficult group to try to separate looking at characters. There are some things to look at. Unfortunately, I did not have a lot of identified material. In a lot of cases, I was just working with the type species. So as more material is gained, hopefully we can get some better resolution among these different species and maybe look at some more distinct characteristics. So as for the big picture, this is really the first time that any phylogenetic analysis has been conducted within the Etymeridae, and there were synapomorphies defined for both Sicinis and the new genus Cantherocicinis. Keys for species to both genera were produced, and that will allow for identification of specimens in museums and private collections that are currently unidentified. I do have a lot of material that I gained just by asking for unidentified neotropical Etymeridae, and I'm in the process of trying to identify a lot of that material, and hopefully that will work out. As for the future of Etymeridae, from here, I would like to examine more of the New World genera. I'd kind of gotten a start at doing that when looking at Sicinis and Diplectris and investigating some of these other outgroups. And it would certainly be handy to be able to produce more keys to species from any more of these groups. Kind of a long-term goal for me would be to revise Arnett's 1950 thesis that he had conducted on Nearctic Etymeridae, since at least a few things have changed since then, and also to start to piece together some of these generic relationships within the Etymerids. And from doing that, hopefully we can kind of build from the ground up and get a better understanding of tribal classifications as well. There's also the potential just for other areas of research, mainly like biochemical, looking at the cantharidin aspects of Etymerid, since it's not known if all Etymerids contain cantharidin. It's likely that they all do, but it's not certain. Maybe some of them have lost that ability. And I'm only one person, and I encourage any up-and-coming coleopterologists to join me in the Etymerid family. Plenty of room for everybody. I have done basically one drop in the large Etymerid bucket out there, and there's a lot I would love to do, but I won't be able to do it all myself. So, thank you.